From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. Secretary of State makes a surprise stop on his Africa tour. A new effort to find peace in Syria gets underway. A Marine general tapped to head the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff and trying to understand the violence in Baltimore.
There is huge drug problem. There are broken families. There's unemployment. There's corruption in the government. And therefore, these issues were simmering for a while.
It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. The top U.S. diplomat, John Kerry, made a surprise visit to Somalia today, becoming the first sitting Secretary of State to visit the war-torn nation. After 20 years of chaos and chronic violence, the Somali capital has become much safer in the last few years, but the government is still dealing with suicide attacks by Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab. Traveling with Kerry and now back in Nairobi, Kenya, is VOA State Department correspondent Pamela Dawkins, who spoke with VOA's Susan Yaki.
Well, Susan, as you mentioned, it is the first time that a sitting Secretary of State has visited the country. The State Department tried to keep the trip under wraps for security reasons until Secretary Kerry arrived in Mogadishu. Once he did, he met with the country's president, the prime minister, regional leaders, and members of civil society. And this included a Somali peace activist and also young African leaders fellows.
Why Somalia now?
A senior State Department official said that the trip was a bid to show U.S. support for Somalia's progress and to thank regional nations who have contributed troops to the African Union peacekeeping mission in Somalia. Secretary Kerry said Somalia has made great progress. He also said he visited Somalia because the country is turning around. He said Somalis have shown resilience and shown that they are determined to reclaim their country and future from terrorists.
And is the U.S. stepping up its engagement in general in Somalia?
Indeed it is. Even before this trip, the U.S. had stepped up engagement with the country. Back in February, U.S. President Barack Obama nominated Catherine Darini, who to serve as the first U.S. ambassador to Somalia since 1991, if she's confirmed by the Senate. She would primarily work out of Kenya, but would make frequent trips into Somalia.
Well, Kerry also visited Kenya, and you know, security was a big concern there as well.
Yes, it is. And as a matter of fact, his visit to Kenya is coming about 1 month after Al-Shabaab militants attacked Garissa University College in Kenya. Shortly after arriving here, Kerry offered condolences to the victims and family members. He said tragedies like this caused momentary turmoil, chaos, and grief, but instead of dividing people, they bring people closer together. He said that border security and law enforcement are part of the issue, but the bigger imperative was persuading people to refrain from joining groups like Al-Shabaab. He said what was needed are efforts to build trust between authorities and local communities.
That's VOA State Department correspondent Pamela Dawkins. She was speaking with us from Nairobi, Kenya. The United Nations is making a renewed effort to find a political solution to Syria's four-year-old civil war as casualties continue to mount. Syria's warring parties have begun informal consultations with the UN Special Envoy on Syria in hopes of restarting stalled peace talks. Lisa Schlein reports from the UN meeting site in Geneva.
Successive efforts to reach a peace accord have all ended in failure. So UN Special Syria Envoy Stefan de Mistura is being cautious and deliberately dampening expectations about the outcome of these talks. He prefers to characterize them as serious consultations. During the next 5 or 6 weeks, he says he and his deputy will engage in one-to-one structured discussions with as many actors involved in the Syrian conflict as possible. De Mistura says the goal is to gauge whether another round of formal peace negotiations will be feasible in the near future.
The Geneva consultations are not a one-off meeting, and they are not a conference. This is not Geneva 3. There is no beginning, no middle, and end here. No big round table with multilateral representation. No big communique expected at the end. And these are not yet peace talks.
De Mistura says he hopes to know by June 30th whether it will be possible to convene Geneva III and restart peace negotiations. The date was chosen because it marks the third anniversary of the so-called Geneva communique that it was agreed to by the Geneva I conference on Syria. A key element of that accord is the establishment of a transitional government body with full executive powers that could include members of the government and opposition. Participants include more than 40 Syrian groups, in addition to the government of Syria, and about 20 regional and international representatives. Noticeably absent are members of the militant groups Islamic State and Nusra Front. They have not been invited because they are deemed terrorist organizations. De Mistura says there is never a good time to start talks, but it is his duty to try and not give up.
What has probably changed is the perception that the whole world has had in June, by the way, when we suddenly, again, all of us, woke up to the fact that the fifth year of this conflict was starting. When in fact 220,000 people have died, and when in fact the conflict was getting even more aggressive and brutal on the ground.
De Mistura says he believes this awakening has produced an inescapable realization that something must be done to end this tragic situation, and waiting any longer is not an option. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Libyan National Conference rejected a draft proposal to end the conflict in the nation that was published by Bernardino Leon, head of the UN support mission in Libya. We've been hearing reaction to that development from Libyan parliamentarian Al-Abu Zakouk. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi.
You said that the proposal has been rejected because it is not based on a comprehensive, balanced solution to the conflict. In your opinion, what would be the balanced solution for what's happening in Libya?
I consider that to be, as a member of the House of Representatives who has boycotted it because it is being built unconstitutionally, and it has from the very beginning really went against the constitutional declaration in Libya. I consider that regardless now, if the House of Representatives, being covered by the recognition, quote-unquote, internationally recognized institution. International recognition does not mean that you control the country. The GNC, the General National Congress, and the National Salvation Government, which is under its command, and the forces that are under the command of the GNC, which is known publicly as Libya Dawn, all of these forces have control over 80% of Libyan geography and 80% of Libyan demography. Tobruk, either the government of Tobruk or the HOR in Tobruk, which are the cities? Tobruk and Baida, that's the cities they control. And population-wise, it doesn't even come to 10% of Libya. Nevertheless, they claim to be the internationally recognized group. And because of that, they wanted to forget or denounce or not recognize the GNC and Libya Dawn and the National Salvation Government because the world does not recognize them. I think it's a mockery of the whole situation. And as a member of the House of Representatives who refused to be actively participating in that meeting in Tobruk, because I told them I cannot meet in Tobruk as an independent member of parliament while from the airport of Tobruk, airplanes going to hit my city, Benghazi. And I am a Benghazi representative. I cannot do that. Ethically and morally and nationally and patriotically, I cannot accept it. So we have to have a balanced solution which does not lean towards Tobruk or toward Tripoli. And that is the failure of the United Nations envoy. He leaned towards Tobruk on the pretext that it is elected by the Libyan people. Even though if we come to numbers and if technicalities, the boycotters, the 30 members who boycotted the meetings in Tobruk, have garnered more votes, popular votes, than the rest of the people who are in Tobruk. That's one. The second point is that the whole issue, the whole elections, the numbers shown that only 16.7% of the Libyan voters participated. Compare that to 64% of the Libyan voters who participated in electing the GNC, the General National Congress. So there is, in any way possible, an opportunity, because the GNC said Libya first, and we are willing to even dissolve ourselves for the sake of Libya. The other side said we are first, and we will not recognize anybody else but us. So the intransigence of the Tobruk group has to be faced by the United Nations envoy and by the world at large, that by this way they cannot reach a political solution for the Libyan crisis.
So what do you expect next with the UN?
I think, as Mr. Leon said in the United Nations, he is not pessimistic, but he is not optimistic. I am optimist because I know that Libyans, at the end, especially the supporters of the revolution of 17th of February, will come to save the country. Now we are in a state of war between the forces of the revolution and the forces of the anti-revolution. I think we have to give in, they have to give in, and a consensual agreement has to come. Otherwise, Libya will not become anymore the country that we called Libya before.
Libyan parliamentarian Al-Abu Zakouk. U.S. President Barack Obama today nominated Marine Corps Commandant General Joseph Dunford as the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the president's senior military advisor. VOA's Victor Beatty reports Dunford's selection comes at a challenging time with a rising China, resurgent Russia, operations in the Middle East and Africa targeting terrorist groups, and looming budget cuts.
The 59-year-old Dunford, only the second Marine to hold the post, has had a meteoric rise through the ranks after serving nearly 2 years as a regimental combat commander in Iraq. Patrick Bratton, director of diplomacy and military studies at Hawaii Pacific University, says Dunford's rapid advancement to four-star rank has been quicker than average.
A lot of his postings, you know, sometimes he's in there for a very short period of time. The way that his career has sort of worked, he's effectively jumped the two-star billet, actually, with the way that his billets have worked. He has both a reputation for very fast advancements to the ranks, and he's also kind of well-regarded as sort of a fighting commander. I think his nickname was Fighting Joe back in Iraq. Also been well-known as well for his coalition-allied contacts, a profile where he's got good links to the international military community with coalition partners, but also seems to be, at least his experience in Iraq, sort of well-regarded by the men who were serving underneath him.
Dunford served 18 months as commander of U.S. and coalition forces in Afghanistan before being named commandant of the Marine Corps last October. The post of JCS chairman requires Senate confirmation to a two-year term. The chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Republican John McCain of Arizona, is quoted as calling Dunford an outstanding leader. He says he's extremely excited about his selection. The ranking Democrat on the committee, Jack Reed of Rhode Island, tweeted that he strongly supports Dunford's nomination, saying he has the experience and vision necessary to lead in these challenging times. Carl Baker, executive director of the Hawaii-based security think tank Pacific Forum, calls Dunford a good choice, likely to sail through the confirmation process because of his Washington connections and vast knowledge of both Iraq and Afghanistan. Baker says as chairman during Mr. Obama's last 2 years in office, Dunford will face a host of challenges, with the fight against the Islamic State group or ISIS and a growing U.S. military presence in Iraq at the top of the list.
How do you deal with the restrictions we have on putting in ground forces? How do you deal with ISIS in general in the Middle East? Is going to be front and center on his plate. But you also have to remember that there's other regions out there. The Asia-Pacific is still out here, and of course, you know, people have said this is going to be the test to see if the United States is really committed to its rebalance to Asia. And so I think that's going to be something that he's going to have to pay attention to. And of course, that includes, you know, paying attention to what China is up to out here and the commitment to the allies and all that.
Baker says Russia's actions in Ukraine have put a lot of strain on the NATO alliance, and that theater will also need the chairman's urgent attention. Bratton says what may make Dunford's job even more difficult is further looming automatic defense spending caps, known as sequestration, which were eased for 2 years in 2013, but set to return at the beginning of the 2016 budget cycle in October. If confirmed as JCS chairman, Dunford would succeed retiring Army General Martin Dempsey, who has served as chairman for 4 years. Mr. Obama is also expected to name Air Force General Paul Selva, currently commander of the U.S. Transportation Command, as vice chairman. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. city of Baltimore is returning to normal after last week's riots that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray, a young black man who died while in police custody. Six officers involved in his arrest, three who are African American, have been charged. Fahim Yunus is an executive committee member of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community of the U.S. and a senior fellow of the Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore. He tells VOA's Susan Yaki he's lived in Baltimore for more than 15 years and was near the epicenter of the unrest the day the violence broke out.
We went there right within 24 hours when the riots happened. And actually what I experienced were peaceful rallies. By the time I was there, there was, of course, a lot of law and order, a lot of police. And we were involved because we were called by a senior citizen center, which is adjacent to the CVS pharmacy that was burned down at West North Avenue and Pennsylvania Avenue. And there were 62 senior citizens who did not have dinner that night. And they called on us that, can you provide food? And our community very quickly gathered, and we had food that we were delivering there. And when I was there, I saw actually very peaceful people.
Well, later on came the violence. So what is the reaction there in Baltimore to what happened to your city?
Yeah, I think people are very angry because this has been simmering for the past decades. You know, there is... The fact remains that 24% of people in Baltimore City live below the poverty line. And the fact remains that there are areas in Baltimore where the life expectancy is less than North Korea. There is huge drug problem. There are broken families. There's unemployment. There's corruption in the government. And therefore, these issues were simmering for a while. And now after, of course, nobody condones violence. Ahmadiyya Muslim community absolutely does not condone any violence or such protests or riots. But people are actually saying, look, I burned down a CVS and all of a sudden I get your attention, but someone comes and kills my son and that never gets the attention. So there is this deep, deep anger.
What is your community's, the Muslim community's, relationship with the police in Baltimore?
We have a very good relationship. Actually, we invite the police to our events, our national convention. We invite police to them. Anytime there is anything, since 9/11, we have an open-door policy. I'm saying this again, that anytime we can be of help to law enforcement agencies, we're always there.
And it seems that many Baltimoreans want to pull together now and rebuild the city.
That's exactly right. And I believe that's what people say. What will change in Baltimore? And to be honest with you, I think not much. I don't know how much can change because the issues are so deep. So I keep telling the group in Ahmadiyya Muslim community that we need to change. What I mean by that is people like us, we need to be more engaged in volunteering, in cleaning up the blocks, in helping out the schools rebuild, in mentoring the children. So I think that is happening. A lot of small groups, a lot of volunteers are coming together. People are realizing that their voices can be heard and they can make some small difference. As far as the politics is concerned, it's very difficult to say which direction it's going to go.
Do you think it's going to be a political issue now?
Absolutely. Everything is a political issue. Of course, there are already people are trying to turn it into a political wedge issue. This is Martin O'Malley is already saying, well, if I run for president, this will be my central issue. There are Al Sharpton was here from New York. The mayor is already very defensive, and she's trying to say, look, I want to move on. And there are others who are accusing the mayor of doing a bad job. And that does not help the average man in the street. That's another one thing which I felt that day, Susan, when I was there at the epicenter. People have deep mistrust. They believe everyone is there with an agenda. Everybody. They look at everybody with suspicion, and I think they are right because there are these secondary agendas. And when people turn these very real issues into politics, that divides us further.
Fahim Yunus, executive committee member of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community of the U.S. and a senior fellow of the Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore, he was speaking with Susan Yockey. Over the last 4 years, commemorative events to mark the 150th anniversary of the U.S. Civil War have brought thousands of visitors to battlefields and historic landmarks across the United States. The final event in the Civil War's sequential honors the final journey home of slain American President Abraham Lincoln. Kane Faraba in the Midwest state of Illinois reports for VOA Television.
We moved from the train and placing the hearse at 11 p.m. 150 years ago, right now.
150 years ago, on this windswept spot near Lake Michigan in Chicago, the coffin holding the remains of assassinated President Abraham Lincoln began a somber return to his hometown of Springfield.
It was total silence, and they took the coffin out of the train and through the large Gothic arch, 40 feet tall.
Dan Weinberg of the Abraham Lincoln Bookshop in Chicago says a concerted effort was made to remain faithful to the past while planning the 150th anniversary commemoration.
There were 36 states in the Union, and they had one young woman dressed in white with a crepe around the dress, each with a lily, that stood at the side of the hearse and then, at the appointed moment, walked around the hearse and placed the lily on the coffin.
Equally faithful to the events that unfolded 150 years ago, was the carefully choreographed reenactment of the procession of Lincoln's body as it arrived in Springfield, May 3, 1865. The replicated coffin and hearse that traveled through Springfield's downtown streets drew thousands of onlookers, young and old, many who dressed in ornately designed period military uniforms and costumes, like Diane and Charles Sanders.
This is a very special occasion. Lincoln was an Illinoisan. He was one of our favorite sons, as well as a renowned national figure.
Sanders says the massive turnout for this event 150 years later is a testament to Lincoln's lasting legacy as the great emancipator who ended slavery in the United States.
People of all races, people of all persuasions, identify with what Lincoln stood for. And we're trying to reconnect today. We're coming back to that. We're trying to reconnect with what Lincoln stood for and what he did.
He's more of a myth than a man.
Pamone Rami of the DuSable Museum of African American History says Abraham Lincoln's assassination on April 15, 1865, at the close of the Civil War, elevated the 16th president's status in America's collective memory.
It's by no accident that we remember the fact that he was murdered. You know, as Frederick Douglass said, had he maybe live to be an old man, our appreciation might have been different, you know. So I think people will always look back and be questioning and judging the impact that he had.
But in the crowd of history enthusiasts who gathered in Springfield, the lens of time focuses on the legacy of one of the most well-known and respected figures in American history. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Springfield, Illinois.
Another major earthquake has rocked Asia, this time south of the Pacific island of New Britain, causing a minor tsunami of about 30 centimeters in Rabaul Harbor. The epicenter of today's 7.4 magnitude quake was about 130 kilometers south-southwest of Kapoko on New Britain. Matthew Mohoy is a seismologist at the Papua New Guinea Geophysical Observatory in the PNG capital of Port Moresby. He tells us the quake is part of increasing seismic activity in the area so far this year.
We had a couple of events that happened before this. Last Thursday on the 30th of April, in the evening, there was one earthquake within the same area. It was measuring like 6.8 event. And then we also have another one on Friday evening within the same location. It measured 6.6 event. Yesterday, Monday, and over the weekend, we had, you know, a couple of like smaller ones in the mid-5s. And yesterday, we had like a couple of them The largest was 5.6 yesterday.
That's Matthew Mahoy. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us, for listening to us on International Edition.